Welcome to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. I'm Lindsay Maynard. Today we will take you to the Cumberland Club in Portland for a recent address from Elliot Cutler, the 2010 Maine Independent Gubernatorial candidate. In addition to being a co-founder of the law firm Cutler & Stanfield, Cutler is the chair and founder of One Maine and serves on the board of directors for Americans Elect. His speech today is entitled, How Do We Get Out of This Mess?, which will focus on unemployment and economic reform. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at your convenience, or to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Penny Carson, president of the Cumberland Club.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much for coming to the November Joshua Chamberlain Lecture Series. My name is Penny Carson, and I am the current president of the Cumberland Club. We are delighted to have with us Elliot Cutler. Elliot is a member of the Cumberland Club, and he was raised in Bangor following his studies at Harvard and Georgetown Law. He forged a career in private enterprise and public service, helping governments, citizen groups, and corporate clients deal with legal and public policy problems. Elliot inherited from his immigrant parents a lifelong commitment to public service. From 1968 to 1973, he worked for U.S. Senator Ed Muskie, helping craft the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, and other environmental laws. Cutler later served in the White House as Associate Director of Natural Resources, Energy, and Science in the Office of Management and Budget, where he was responsible for overseeing the policies and the billions of taxpayer dollars at the Department of Agriculture, Energy, and Interior, and at the Environmental Protection Agency. A seasoned negotiator, Elliot represented the president in the negotiations that led to the settlement of the Maine Indian Land Claims case. He also served as White House Energy Policy Chief during the energy crisis of the late 1970s. As an independent candidate in Maine's 2010 gubernatorial election, Elliot garnered 36.3% of the votes, the highest percentage of any independent candidate for major office in the United States in 2010, and the strongest finish among all first-time independent candidates for governor in Maine. Since the election, Elliot has founded and chairs One Maine, a nonpartisan political action committee that supports candidates of all stripes who will work to improve the state's political climate. We have an experienced, wonderful speaker here, and I thank you for coming, and let us now hear Elliot Cutler. Okay, I'll clean up.
We'll take my speech. I was afraid Penny was going to take my speech along with hers. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you all for coming. Thank you also, those of you who helped me last year, thank you for that. I'm grateful to you. I remain grateful. This is a wonderful club. After the election, this was where I licked my wounds just about every day. And the staff here is was wonderful to me. We finally moved to some offices on 4 Milk Street, but for months and months, this was my post-election office, and it was a kind and nurturing place to be. I understand that I was preceded in this lecture series by Governor LePage, so I'm second again. I don't intend to spend the rest of my life finishing second. Earlier this week, as I was preparing this lecture, I set aside some time to reflect upon the similarities between my career and General Chamberlain's. He was born in Brewer, and I was born right across the river in Bangor. That's about it. It didn't take nearly as much time as I'd hoped it would. I'm sort of the anti-Chamberlain. He was a great general, and I was 4F. He was president of Bowdoin College, and I was lucky that I was admitted to a good college. And he was elected governor, and I wasn't. And then I read the letter that was sent to Joshua Chamberlain from his friend General Warren, when General Warren learned of Chamberlain's candidacy for governor. And I quote from General Warren's letter. "From what I know of the parties in Maine, I presume your election is a certainty," Warren wrote. No one ever wrote a letter like that to me. Not until after the election. General Chamberlain and I do share one other experience in common. We both were longtime Democrats who took the risk of leaving the party and found success outside it. In his case, of course, as a Republican. I think I understand the risk that Chamberlain decided to take. Considering risk was what I did for a living for most of my career. I advised, as Penny said, senators, a president and vice president, candidates and clients to take risks, to say or to do things that often flew in the face of conventional wisdom. I've sat on public company boards of directors, and I've started new businesses. I've watched over other people's money and invested my own. When I decided to run for governor, I took the biggest and at the same time the most considered risk that I've ever taken or advised anyone else to take. And though I spent far more money than was sensible, the most important risks that I took in 2010 weren't financial. Rather, I risked peace of mind, family harmony, the love of my wife, Melanie, and a reputation that I had worked years to build, because I believed then, as I believe even more deeply now, that our state and our nation are in trouble. And once again, not channeling Chamberlain, I doubled down on all those risks by taking on the two entrenched parties and running as an independent. The only regret that I have about my campaign for governor last year is that we lost. I don't regret my decision to run, the nature of my candidacy, or my absolute refusal to engage in negative campaigning. And it was fun to boot. I came away from our 2010 campaign invigorated and encouraged, and with these two firm conclusions. First, my fundamental optimism about the future of Maine and America was fully reinforced. Notwithstanding the long, dark night to which we seemingly awake every morning, the elements of greatness are still alive in Maine and in America. But, and this is a big but, we share nearly universal misgivings that the failings of our political process are keeping us from repeating and reliving the great successes of our nation's past. We are almost desperately hungry for political reform, and I have fully immersed myself this year in three big efforts to achieve it. I have founded, as Penny said, One Maine. It's a political home for people, Democrats, Republicans, Greens, unenrolled independents, who are more interested in pragmatic solutions than in political partisanship. It's a place for people who care less about parties and more about common interests and shared purpose. I've joined the board of directors of Americans Elect, a new web-based nominating system that will place a bipartisan presidential and vice presidential ticket on the ballot in all 50 states in 2012, and that will reconnect millions of American people with their political process. And I am searching for the best way to overcome the Supreme Court's decision in the Citizens United case and to protect our political process from the scourge of big money. Thank you. So why am I doing this? I pride myself on never having done anything quixotic in my entire life, and none of these are quixotic ventures. The answer to why I'm doing it is that I believe that the conditions necessary for reform to succeed now have been generated by the confluence of three things. First, deep-seated fears over some of the greatest challenges our democracy has ever faced. Second, widespread dissatisfaction with our increasingly anachronistic politics. And third, a broadly shared yearning for a renewal of the national spirit. What are the fears? Why are we all so worried? Well, there are three good reasons for it. Number one, too few Americans are working, and too many Americans are less capable of working. Two, the economic divide that separates a few of us from most of us has become a wider, deeper, and ever more threatening chasm. And third, we have lost trust in our government and faith in each other. Many of those who have the money to do so are corrupting our political system, alienating more and more Americans from it, and discouraging participation in it. Now let's look at some facts, starting with jobs and employment. You know, America has always recovered from recessions. So the employment picture coming out of an economic downturn usually looks like either a V or a U. Typically a U, sometimes elongated, but always with an end to it, a recovery. Not now, not this one. Measured by jobs and employment, this recession is long and deep with no substantial improvement on the horizon. Neither Maine's official rate of about 7% or the official national rate of 9% unemployment fairly state the horrible burden, the horrible human dimension of this joblessness epidemic. Embedded in that 9% figure are facts like these. Even the reported unemployment rate among women veterans is 14.7%, while among men veterans it's 11.1%. For Americans under the age of 24, the reported rate is 24%. And a high school diploma is no longer the protection it used to be. The reported rate for males between 20 and 24 with a high school diploma is 22.4%, while it's 14.4% for male high school graduates between 25 and 34. Why do I keep emphasizing the words official or reported? Because the 9% national unemployment figure, or the 7% in Maine, includes only people who have looked for work in the last 4 weeks. Another 2.5% didn't look for work in the last 4 weeks, but did at some point during the last 12 months. 1.9%, another nearly 2%, hasn't looked for more than 12 months. And there are 5.6% who are working part-time but want full-time work. So, measured more honestly, the real unemployment rate in America today is 19.1%. We should be grateful that our official rate in Maine is lower than in the rest of the country. Yet, nearly 8% of those who are employed here in Maine hold down multiple jobs in order to make ends meet. And that multiple jobs number in Maine is nearly 50% higher than the national average. Unfortunately, But realistically, we can't expect to see an immediate and dramatic improvement in these awful statistics because our state and national policies have not been nearly as strategic, innovative, nimble, and adaptive as we should expect them to be. Stupid. Stupid. There's no other word that fits. Stupid immigration policies are keeping out of our country young people with skills that we need, and ossified public education systems are performing so poorly that 30% of our children aren't graduating from high school. More than 10 years ago, the National Association of Manufacturers reported that 40% of America's 17-year-olds lack the math skills and 60% lack the reading skills to hold down a production job in a modern manufacturing company. And we haven't improved much since then. According to Secretary of Education Duncan, 75% of young Americans are unable to enlist in the military because they have failed to graduate from high school, have a criminal record, or are physically unfit. Although a toxic political environment has rendered the public policymaking process nearly sclerotic, hardened, inflexible, and rigid, American employers have been doing an extraordinarily good job of inventing and deploying non-human capital. Productivity is way up since 2000, outstripping even prodigious increases during the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Higher productivity is good for the economy because it makes us more competitive. Average profit margins at major companies are now close to 13%, the highest level in 50 years. It is no wonder that the stock market remains buoyant. But as machines get smarter and people don't, American companies are hiring fewer and fewer people. The next time you hear someone tell you that all we need to do to create jobs in Maine or in America is to increase corporate profits, clue them into this fact. Since the end, the alleged end of the recession in June of 2009, corporate spending on equipment and software has increased by 26%, but payrolls have been flat. As corporate profits recover and company executives and shareholders prosper, it's increasingly and painfully clear from data on incomes and poverty that much of the larger nation is not participating in that recovery or sharing in that prosperity. The effects of these immigration, education, and employment trends are murderous. For the very first time in history, American employees took home less than half of the nation's total income in 2010. Between 1970 and 2010, the share of the nation's total income claimed by the top quintile, those of us in the top 20%, increased by 17%. While the percentage shared by all other Americans, the other 80%, declined. Between 1970 and 2010, the share of after-tax income taken home by the top 1% more than doubled. Those in the top 1% of our population now haul in about one-fourth of total U.S. incomes, and they own about 40% of the nation's total wealth. Indeed, 400 people in the United States control more wealth than the poorest 150 million combined. Those 400 earners, incidentally, earned an average of $340 million each in 2007 and paid 17% of their income in taxes. Now, while the Census Bureau and the Department of Labor struggle to figure it all out, trying to separate the merely very poor from the very, very, very poor, this much is clear. More Americans, numbering around 40 million and including about 12.5% of our neighbors here in the state of Maine, More Americans live lives of desperation than at any time since these statistics were first gathered. Among all industrialized nations, we have one of the highest percentages of citizens living in poverty. We are creating wealth in America. We're just not sharing very much of it. So where's all that money going? Well, one place it's going is into politics, and that's not good. The sheer force of money in politics today is corroding and corrupting politics, capitalism, and civil society. The Supreme Court's decision in the Citizens United case opened the floodgates to billions of dollars in hidden political spending. That's the case that essentially stands for the propositions that corporations are citizens with First Amendment rights, and that the protection of our political system from corruption and distortion is not a sufficient reason to regulate and contain the exercise of those rights. Now, I'm a lawyer, or at least I used to be a lawyer. I want you to remember that later. As a lawyer, I appreciate as much as anyone the difficult choices that emerge from the collision between our commitment to the First Amendment and our desire to protect our political and electoral process. But I think those lawyerly arguments get trumped by a couple of simple bumper stickers that I've seen in the last few months. The first was this: would you let your sister marry a corporation? And the second read, if corporations are people, when is Texas going to execute an oil company? Now, the irony, of course, is that we will need to raise and spend money in order to elect candidates to public office who are committed to getting money out of politics. So one main will have a PAC, but it will be one where all of the donors will be identified and reported. That's not so for the super PACs, labor unions, big corporations, the Koch brothers, and no one really knows who else. No one really knows who else. Who are all fighting with each other over the core of our democracy, buying elections all over America, and corrupting our political process nearly beyond recognition. Outside non-candidate and non-party spending in political campaigns has increased 338% since 2006. More of that spending now comes from undisclosed donors than comes from those who identify themselves. And you can safely bet that most of it pays for vicious negative advertising that contributes nothing, absolutely nothing, to the sort of civic dialogue that the world's longest-lasting democracy has every right to expect. It's no wonder that increasing numbers of Americans have thrown up their hands and walked away from politics. There has never been less trust and participation in the political process than we see today. Now, those of us who are as old as I am remember our civics teachers in junior high school and high school telling us that our two-party system was America's secret sauce. Though it's never mentioned in the Constitution, the two-party system we were taught was one of the pillars of our democracy. No more. Our two great political parties have become increasingly irrelevant to most people and may be nearing the ends of their lives. Once vigorous, broad, and inclusive, the Democratic and Republican parties have shrunk and narrowed, migrating further to the right and left sides of our political spectrum where, not incidentally, the super PAC money chiefly resides. As they've drifted away from the center, the two parties have defined themselves into silos, trapped by funding sources and narrowed ideologies that keep them from bridging the differences between them. How else can we explain the incredible paralysis that has so far prevented the President and the Congress from solving the budget mess? Who in the world elected Grover Norquist, the promoter of a no new taxes pledge that has tied otherwise sensible Republicans up in knots? for that matter, who put the AARP so squarely in charge of Social Security and Medicare that many congressional Democrats maintain that any changes in entitlement programs are off limits? Reacting to this spectacle, the American people have jumped ship. Fewer and fewer Americans call themselves Democrats or Republicans these days. As recently as 2008, 3 years ago, 40% of registered voters identified themselves as Democrats. 40%. That share has fallen to 30% in 2011 nationally. In 2008, 29% called themselves Republicans, but that number's dwindled to 22% in just these last 3 years. And even fewer people are sufficiently motivated to vote in party primaries. This is a stunning statistic that I'm going to tell you right now. The percentage of the voting age population who voted in Democratic primaries was 21%. In 1966. In 1966, 21% of the voting age population voted in Democratic primaries. That number collapsed to 8% in 2010. These parties are remnants of another time. But, the Democratic and Republican parties continue to exercise political authority far out of proportion to the rapidly declining allegiance they command from the electorate. In primaries and caucuses, more and more dominated by big money and narrow interests, and in which fewer and fewer of us choose to participate, Democrats and Republicans still nominate the so-called major candidates from whom we choose in our fall general elections. Legitimate absentee voting has morphed into early or convenience voting so that ballots can be cast for the major candidates weeks, months before voters are paying enough attention to realize that they may have other and sometimes better choices. Campaign spending laws, that is, those laws that are left following Citizens United, campaign spending laws have been designed to favor the parties. And in the absence of open primaries and runoff voting, candidates spend more time firing up the base than they spend campaigning for votes from the majority of us who are centrists. Our political system is stuck in a time warp. It is increasingly unresponsive to the needs of a society that has been transformed socially, culturally, and economically during the last several decades. And the consequences of our obsolete electoral system are downright ugly. 84% of the American people think the Congress is doing a lousy job, while only 9% approve of its performance. This is its worst rating ever. Here's how bad that number is. Nixon, during Watergate, had a 24% approval rating. Even lawyers today have a 29% approval rating, and the IRS is at 40%. The three words most used by poll respondents to describe both parties in the deficit reduction debacle, three words, were stupid, disgusting, and ridiculous. Only 10% of the American people today believe that they can trust the federal government. Again, the lowest level of confidence ever recorded. No wonder that more and more people look at the process and its results and just walk away. Nearly 80% of the American people are dissatisfied with the way the political system is working, and those feelings are intense. 45% describe themselves as very dissatisfied. Now, I think that America's problems, economic and political, are all of a piece. Born from political and electoral dysfunction, a sharply divided and uncivil Congress has failed to enact sound and sensible national policies. These policy failures have led to a crushing debt burden, a longer-lasting recession than any we have experienced since the Great Depression, and deepening divides that have us doubting our past and fearing our future. And, closing this vicious cycle, our national condition has deepened the divides among us, reinforcing the very brand of politics that's brought us nearly to our knees. Professors Ted Marmor and Jerry Mayshaw suggested recently in the New York Times that even our political discourse has deteriorated over the last few decades. They're right. We now talk more about programs and budgets than we talk about people and their circumstances. In 1934, they wrote, the focus was on people, family security, and the risks to economic well-being that we all share. Today, the people have disappeared. I see that and I hear that even as I travel around our own state. If the people of any state in America ought to know and understand interdependence, it's we who live in the state of Maine. We number but 1.3 million people. We're the only state that borders on just one other. Yet of late, the bedrock values of fairness and opportunity seem to have vanished from our political lexicon. We've lost our sense of shared enterprise and mutual obligation. And we find ourselves with no compelling and shared vision of Maine's future. Perhaps the very first change that we need to make here in Maine and across America is to talk about these challenges differently. What will constitute Maine's political dialogue in 2012? Will it be drug testing for welfare recipients? Or instead, shouldn't we debate the best strategy to rebuild our export economy and educate our children for 21st century jobs so that our welfare rolls stop growing? Will it be photo IDs for voting? Or wouldn't it be better to talk about how we can open up the political process? These are the kinds of questions that we need to answer for ourselves in Maine and around America. We can control the political dialogue. We are the people who can make these choices. I've made mine. I've made my choices. I hope that you will join me in Americans Elect. I hope that you will join me in One Maine. I hope that you will remember that when Joshua Chamberlain went back to Gettysburg to dedicate the monuments at Gettysburg to the 20th Maine and to the men from Maine who fought in the Civil War, he quoted the speech that Abraham Lincoln had given just 25 years earlier in that same place, that America was a government by the people and for the people, and that it must never vanish from this earth. And he talked about the common good. He said that was what Lincoln was talking about, and that's what we need to talk about here in Maine and here in America. We can change the political system. We can rebuild democracy. We can restore the economy. We can't do it sitting on our hands. We can't do it the way it's been done before. It's a new time. We need a new political system. We need a revived democracy, and we need people who are willing to engage. Thank you so very much for coming tonight.
Very nice,
A lot of questions.
Well, thank you, Elliot, very much. There are a lot of questions here. We're going to take the time. We're going to move through them. I'm not worried about Elliot. We'll have an answer for every one of these, I'm sure. So I'm going to start right out. Elliot, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Of all the things that the present governor is doing and hope to do during the remainder of his term, which one or two will have the most serious negative consequences for Maine and will be the hardest to overcome or change once the right people again occupy the State House? They told me you could answer them all.
I can. I'm not running for anything. I want to let me say first that that I think that the governor's job right now is the most difficult, perhaps, that it's ever been. And I think that there are a lot of things that Governor LePage is doing that, had I won 9,000 more votes, I would be having to do. There aren't a whole lot of choices. I have been supportive of many of the proposals that he's made that I think make sense for the state of Maine. I've testified in favor of, I did testify in favor of one of his appointees, Steve Bowen, who's the education commissioner, who I think is a very talented young man and is doing a very good job. The governor is going to be making some proposals to reorganize the higher education system, our public higher education system in Maine, and I'm hopeful that those proposals will track those that I made 3 years ago. I think they may. I've been very supportive of his proposals to increase the use of natural gas and to move natural gas around the state of Maine as a way to help relieve our burden on fuel oil. I think that what's missing is a strategy for Maine's future. If you go anywhere in Maine and ask people, as I could ask you tonight, where is Maine going to be 20 years from now? How are we going to get there? What are our kids' jobs going to be? What's the economic foundation of Maine going to be in 20 years? When you ask people in Maine that question, they just look at you. We don't have in Maine today a common understanding of what we need to do. We don't have a shared investment in what we need to do. There's an unwillingness as a consequence to make the kinds of sacrifices and long-term investments that we need to make in order to relive, as I suggested earlier, our greatness. It's not a problem unique to Maine. It's a problem that we face in America. I happen to think it's a consequence of the political system. I've said that tonight. And I think we need to reform the political system. So I've not really answered your question, whoever asked it, and I don't intend to. I think it's a tough job. He's trying to do the best he can, and I think we need to give him a little more time to try to do it.
Good job. I'm going to read this question, and it's in two parts.
I'm reading over your shoulder.
Okay. The Occupy movement. A, dope smoking losers who should get a job. B, the only avenue left for a marginalized population without means to buy a politician. Or C, none of the above.
That is a good question. I think the Occupy movement and the Tea Party both spring from the same place in America today. They spring from a sense of frustration and anger and hopelessness that is abroad in our land. We live in a terrible time in these respects. When nearly 20% of our people are unemployed, when we have 40 million or more living in poverty, when the income gap is growing wider and wider, this is a terribly difficult and challenging time. And I can imagine how people who can't find work feel. I can imagine how people feel about some of the bonuses that have been paid to executives in New York and others. I can imagine, as I imagine some couple, 2 or 3 years ago, where the Tea Party voices were coming from. This is an expression of rage and frustration and anger, and the answer is to try to do something about the problems that are making it happen.
There are four questions here. I'm just going to read them. They're all the same in a different set of words. What are your plans for the future? What are your political aspirations? And are you going to run for governor?
That's four.
Well, they put them all together.
Sorry. I'm asked a lot whether I'm going to run again for governor, and what I've come to say over and over again is that the answer is not no, but it's not yet yes. This is awfully early. I meant what I said a few minutes ago. I think we need to give Governor LePage a chance to succeed because it's in our best interest that he do succeed. That he does succeed, sorry. Melanie looked at me with this. Right. I'm obviously, as obvious from what I've said tonight and what I'm doing with my life and my time, I'm by no means receding from politics, and I intend to stay involved. I intend for One Maine to be a force. I'm on the board of directors of Americans Elect. It's AmericansElect.org. I invite you to visit that website. I invite you to visit OneMaine.com. I'm deeply engaged in politics and intend to continue to be deeply engaged, and we'll see what happens in a couple of years.
Both the university and community colleges spend precious resources providing remedial education in math and English for graduates of Maine's high schools. Seems like a tremendous waste of scarce resources. What can be done?
Oh, a lot. I talked about public education probably and health care were the two issues I spoke most about, I think, last year. Not as social issues, but as the keys to revitalizing Maine's economy. The cost of health care in the state of Maine, the quality of education, public education in the state of Maine, and the cost of electricity in the state of Maine are the three biggest problems that we have to solve as a matter of public policy in order to rebuild our state's economy. Public education in Maine has seen in the last 20 or 30 years a decline in quality. What the questioner wrote about the preparation of students who end up at the community colleges or in the university system as freshmen is exactly right. The numbers, the statistics are startling. 20-25% who need remedial work in fundamental subjects like English and math in order to complete their freshman year in community colleges or in the university system. We spend on a per pupil basis a very substantial amount of money in Maine compared with other states. Compared with other states, we have more teachers per student than any other state in America except for one, Vermont. We trade places with Vermont. And so we're not getting the quality that we need to get from what we're spending. I had a lot of very specific proposals in the campaign. I'm not going to repeat them all. But the only way we're going to solve the problem of kids coming to our community colleges and to our universities unprepared to do the work is to fix our public schools in the state of Maine. And let me just say one other thing. And that is going to take investment. Not necessarily more money, but money better spent.
Will a third-party effort benefit the Republican or the Democratic Party?
First of all, Americans Elect is a second nominating process. It's not a third party. I want to make that point. My answer is it's going to benefit the American people. I don't see it helping one party or the other. It's going to involve millions of Americans. Over 2 million Americans have already signed ballot access petitions. 330,000 people have registered as delegates in the AmericansElect.org website. I have said, and I believe it will be true, that more Americans will participate directly in the Americans Elect nominating process than will vote or caucus in all of the Republican and Democratic primaries and caucuses combined. This is reinvigorating our democracy. It will produce a bipartisan ticket. There's not a risk of the election going into the, or an increased risk of the election going into the House of Representatives because of Americans Elect, because if no slate of candidates has a majority of electors going into the meeting of the Electoral College, then the Americans Elect delegates will re-vote to instruct Americans Elect electors which way to go. This is a much more promising way of reinvigorating the political process in the United States than any that I've seen in 20 years. If you just think about what I said a couple minutes ago, more Americans will participate in this process than in the other two parties' processes combined. That means something. It's important. And I promise you that if you will go to the website, if you'll go to the One Main website, if you'll go to the Americans Elect website, you'll get engaged. And you'll feel good that you're engaged again.
How do you envision the new information technologies bringing transformation, being a transforming agent in politics?
Perfect follow-on question to what I was just saying, because the website from, let me go back a year, to a year, if I can stand it. The most effective advertising that we did in my gubernatorial campaign was on Google and Yahoo. The most effective advertising was Google and Yahoo. One of the most effective outreach efforts, organizing efforts that we had was the effort we made through Facebook and other social media. We had three people working in the office full-time on social media. That's how I got from being someone no one knew, literally, less than 1% name recognition, to almost winning. Now we come to the presidential race in 2012 and to Americans Elect. This is a web-based nominating process. If you want to be a delegate, you go to the website and you register, and you're a delegate. And you get to vote on issues, on platform, on candidates. You'll read the rules. I promise you, you'll come away impressed. So this process, which is being designed, this website has been designed by a fellow named Joshua Levine, a team led by Joshua Levine. Joshua Levine was the fellow who designed the website for E-Trade when everyone was saying that no one will ever trade stocks online. This is bringing the political process into the 21st century. You know, socially, culturally, and in so many other ways, we're a 21st century society. But our political process is stuck somewhere back in about 1940. Mm-hmm. And it's no wonder that people just go, huh, we got to fix that. And the technology is giving us the way to do it.
Thank you. We are on a schedule here, and I really have one more time, one more question.
You don't want dinner to get cold.
That's true.
Right.
One more question, and this is a positive question. No doubt there are plenty of topics and issues that will continue to polarize Americans, but what issues do you see that will unite Americans?
You know, that's a great question. And I tried to answer it in some respects tonight. I've tried to answer it. I keep working at it. I don't know about all of you, but I still get choked up when I think about America's past and America's future, about Maine's past and Maine's future. My grandfather, as many of you know, was an immigrant, and he was a peddler, and he walked from Bangor to Calais and back on the airline for years before he finally settled in Bangor. One of the most emotional experiences of my life came in 1978 or 9. You'll appreciate this. When I was the number two person in a U.S. delegation sent to Russia, to the Soviet Union, to renegotiate an exchange, science and technology exchange agreement. And we did the work in Moscow, and we signed the agreement. And then, this was in the middle of the winter, we took the Red Arrow overnight train from Moscow to what was then called Leningrad, now St. Petersburg again. And the Russians had arranged for us to go to the Kirov Ballet. My grandfather had come to America at the age of 12 to escape conscription into the Tsar's army. He came alone. He was sent here by himself. And because I was the second person, second ranking member of the delegation, I sat in the Tsar's box. My grandfather had died many, many years before, but I couldn't help but think how extraordinary he would find the idea that his grandson, whom he used to take to ride buses in Bangor on Saturdays, was sitting in the Tsar's box as an honored guest of the Russian government. That possibility, which now must exist in the United States for Somalis, for Sudanese, for Laotians, for others, that possibility unites Americans. The idea that this is still a country to which people can emigrate, be educated, find opportunity, contribute, raise a family, assume American values and names and traditions. More than anything else, I think that idea and that ideal unites the American people. And people are trying to scare us away from that. And we must not let them do it.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN. Today's speaker was Elliot Cutler, the 2010 Maine Independent gubernatorial candidate. You can listen to the program again at any time by accessing it on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand or Podcast to access this program, as well as many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. If you'd like to purchase a taped copy of today's Speaking in Maine, please call MPBN's Audience Services Department at 1-800-884-1717. Again, for a copy of today's Speaking in Maine with Elliot Cutler, the number to call is 1-800-884-1717. Charles Beck is the executive producer of this series. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Lindsay Maynard.